Hello and welcome to episode 52 of Unfrozen. I'm your host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik. Today our guest is Brian Goldstein. He is a historian of the American built environment and an associate professor of architectural history in the Department of Art and Art History at Swarthmore College. Previously, he was an assistant professor in the School of Architecture and Planning at the University of New Mexico and an A.W. Mellon postdoctoral fellow in the Center for the Humanities at the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He received his Ph.D. from Harvard University in 2013, and he's here today because he is the author of The Roots of Urban Renaissance, Gentrification, and the Struggle Over Harlem. Brian, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a really interesting book. A lot of people think they know the story of Harlem, the Harlem Renaissance, of course, the activism that happened in the 1960s. Today, I guess people kind of think of it as a thoroughly gentrified neighborhood, but that's a sort of an oversimplification. So I guess what I'd like to dive into first is just a general sense of what prompted you to want to write about this, and what do you think is the untold story of gentrification in Harlem?
Sure. Well, that's a great question to start with. And of course, you've started with the very most complicated question of all. So I'll try to sum up some of the answers to that, and I'm sure we'll get to more during our conversation. The motivation to write about this as a kind of historical project was twofold. One was that there's a moment in the 1960s when the kind of pitch and vibrancy of the civil rights movement is so great that it ends up shaping architecture and planning also. And as a historian of architecture and planning, I was interested in the ways that history really hadn't been written, and found very quickly that Harlem was one of the most evocative sites where you could see the demands for equality kind of coming into the ways that people were imagining the built environment. And in particular, that happens through a group of activist architects and planners who come to be known as the Architects Renewal Committee in Harlem. The second kind of motivation was understanding a backstory. I think, as you described, there's this way in which, really starting in the 1990s, Harlem becomes known as a kind of exemplar of a particular style of development that's happening in a lot of American cities. And, of course, because there's the first Renaissance in Harlem, it becomes widely known as the second Renaissance. And that's a phrase you could see in a lot of media in that era. But it always seemed to me that there was a much more complicated story happening. On one hand, the story of Harlem's changes was often told as a story of, outsiders coming into Harlem, the supermarkets, the shopping centers. On the other hand, there was this kind of strange way in which Harlemites who had been living in Harlem all along were absent from the story. And that struck me as a social historian as weird because, of course, even though Harlem did have its definite struggles in the 70s and 80s into the 90s, there were people living there, and those people, just like any other people, had visions for their neighborhood, and I felt like those visions were really quite absent. So the second kind of effort I wanted to make was to try to understand, how this story that maybe is in some sort of recognizable form by 2000 is actually the result of a much longer process. And I was very surprised to find, real links between kind of the radical 1960s and the gentrified second Renaissance 1990s.
I want to ask Brian, what really was there a signal moment when it comes to the second Renaissance? I mean, I recall as a then young New Yorker, of course, the arrival of Magic Johnson and his investor group. That was sort of seen as a watershed moment, and then of course also the very canny decision by then former President Clinton to locate his office in Harlem. And those two together, I think, really changed the narrative for white New Yorkers at the end of the Giuliani years, beginning of the Bloomberg years. Is that the correct perception? Or what were some of the forces behind those decisions? I'm always curious about what really funneled capital through those sort of two conduits.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think certainly in kind of the world of, the story of New York City told through the mainstream media, those are absolutely the two signals. And I remember those. I did not grow up in New York City, but I remember, those moments extremely well. I think they were symbolic. And as, urban histories are often told in public, they're, watershed moments, but of course are the result of much, much longer histories. So, the Magic Johnson arrival is part of Harlem, USA. Harlem, USA was this first shopping mall on 125th Street. It's still there. It's at 125th and St. Nicholas, and it's a notable building. It's kind of largely transparent, about three stories, and it has the movie theater on the upper stories. Arrival of Clinton was into the Vincent Building, which is a shorter skyscraper on 125th Street, not the state office building, but a little east of that. And that is where he puts his post-presidential office, and I think some of the foundation offices after he is done in the White House. Both stories are interesting because I do think they speak to some of the larger themes of the book. Certainly the Magic Johnson story does quite directly, because that shopping mall rose on a site that the first community development corporation in Harlem, which is called the Harlem Commonwealth Council and still exists, that was a piece of land that they had owned, I believe, since the mid-70s, and also a piece of land that they had eyed for a shopping mall for a very long time. So it's a great example, I suppose, of what I was talking about earlier, you know, the ways that these things that arrive actually are, you know, had been on the boards for many years. In that case, a development organization that had a lot of big dreams and did own some land, but ultimately in the 90s needed capital. And so the sources of capital came through the Empowerment Zone, which was a Clinton-era program that incentivized private development in places like Harlem, and then through the involvement of a private developer in partnership with the Harlem Commonwealth Council. So that's a really great example in some ways of the sort of central role that community organizations gain in development by the 90s, and also of the ways that changing policy regimes played in seeding that development, Clinton's signature urban policy being at the center of it. And then, you know, that's also where you can see Clinton arriving in Harlem, which is the idea that this idea of a kind of public-private, federal government-seeded development approach that in some ways comes from what are sort of Thatcher-era policies in England, you know, evolved through an American lens to be kind of bipartisan. You know, he's able to sort of show his work in a place like Harlem, Clinton is. So it made sense that, you know, Clinton would want to be there. And of course, the symbolic attachment between Clinton and African-American voters was quite strong still at that moment. So it was interesting. I believe he still maintains some square footage there, although, you know, as his world has expanded, he's also, you know, has presences elsewhere, which I think the Harlem office remains intact, though.
Well, we did. You did mention the state office building in this conversation, and we should probably explain for the listeners, you know, what the significance of that building is. For those of you who are not New Yorkers or don't know Harlem, it is still the largest, tallest skyscraper in the district. It was finally constructed in 1973 after some very long deliberation, and actually the reclaiming of the site. They didn't call it the Empowerment Zone, but there was a reclamation site number one, I believe activists called it, because it wasn't so much that the residents didn't want the building, they just wanted to make sure that they had a voice in how a significant site would be developed. So let's talk a little bit about that building and why that became such a lightning rod for the community.
Yeah, to understand the story of the state office building, I think you have to sort of understand the longer history of post-war development, which in a lot of New York sort of embodied by the character of Robert Moses in a way that many people are now familiar with, is a sort of idea of a federally funded, locally administered, large scale of development that happens through clearance and reconstruction called urban renewal or urban redevelopment, typically for the purpose of bringing middle-class people back into cities that were losing their tax base. That's kind of the simplest way to describe it. But in the course of doing that, a lot of cities, New York certainly not excluded, the people who were impacted by clearance were often people of color, low-income people, people who were politically in less agile positions with which to oppose it. And so by the late 60s, Harlem had seen extensive redevelopment, especially in East Harlem. There was, I believe, over 100 acres reconstructed to build public housing, a lot of which is where people who are displaced from other projects were relocated. That was true in Central and West Harlem also. That becomes kind of a real part of the ways that civil rights activists are thinking about their work in a place like Harlem, that, you know, it wasn't just about desegregating schools. It wasn't just about equal access to political power or resources. It was also about who had a say in development. And by the late 60s, kind of as radical tides are growing in the civil rights movement, and there's increasing demands for what's called community control, urban renewal really becomes very symbolic of a way in which places like Harlem don't get to make decisions for themselves. So in the mid-60s, New York State announces the plan to build the World Trade Center, which, of course, we know, you know, is downtown, two towers. There are a number of moderate African-American leaders in Harlem, civil rights leaders, who don't see urban renewal necessarily as a purely negative possibility, but as one that would bring resources to a place like Harlem if it sort of was somewhat meeting the needs of the community. And so they ask for essentially a third World Trade Center building to be built in Harlem. Nelson Rockefeller, the very powerful governor of New York, eventually sees the sort of political wisdom of this and announces a plan to build a state office building in Harlem. Well, by the time that is ready to begin construction in 1969, things have changed. The younger activists, who often have a much more radical, much less gradual approach to civil rights demands, see this not as a way to bring resources into Harlem, but as a real threat to the idea of control and the idea that they would have a right to determine their community. So in 1969, as you said, there's a three-month occupation of what was to become the state office building site. And people sort of build their own community there in many ways using, you know, basic means like tents, wooden shelters, a kind of cooperative community building effort that is in some ways modeling a radical idea of Harlem that's built by and for its residents. To make a long story short, that was quite a powerful moment, but it wasn't enough to stop Rockefeller, who was one of the most powerful, you know, state leaders in the country, and he does clear the site. And begins construction of the state office building, which, as you said, in fact, is built. The outcome of that is really interesting because it in some ways shows a state that's trying to navigate the complicated politics of the late 1960s. And to his credit, perhaps Rockefeller and Edward Logue, who was the head of the Urban Development Corporation in New York State, the essentially kind of statewide urban redevelopment organization, they try to find a way to sort of salvage some ideas of community control from this. And one of the ways they do that is the Harlem Urban Development Corporation, which is a kind of partly community-based group, which we can perhaps talk a little bit about later. Part of it is the idea that the state office building will be used for community purposes. And part of it eventually is just the idea that the state wants this building built and it's going to be built because they don't want to sort of fully lose power in New York City. The state office building exists today, and you know it's a concrete skyscraper structure. It was designed by African American architects, which perhaps suggests some of the complexity at the root of this story. That it, in many ways, was a transition between a kind of idea of civil rights as an integration model to one that, you know, had moved to more radical ideals, and in some ways represents the loss of this particular idea of a Harlem controlled by its community, and in some ways exemplifies the ways that there's sort of a sorting out after the 1960s to try to figure out, you know, what development's going to be in the aftermath of these really disruptive moments. So it's a complex symbol, and it's a symbol in some ways that maybe we can keep talking about, you know, has continued to embody that complexity for, you know, 50 years now, and very much an icon of the neighborhood, maybe despite this early history, which is not so well known.
Although he wasn't the architect of this building, a big player in the history that you're describing here is J. Max Bond Jr., who later became the principal of Davis Brody Bond, which is kind of the go-to firm for architectural works of significance that chronicle the African American community, including the National Museum in Washington, D.C. So, but he had a role as sort of an activist, and as also sort of an early, he did his early work as an architect, you know, in that neighborhood and in those efforts. Could you talk about the enduring influence of his having been involved?
Yeah, I mean, Bond comes up through the group I mentioned earlier, the Architects Renewal Committee in Harlem. He is a person who's starting a kind of independent architectural career, just as Harlem is becoming a more radical place and starting to think in more radical ways about its built environment. And so he has been in Ghana for 3 years, 1964 to 67, when he returns to Harlem. And he returns to a Harlem that's different, and he's also experienced his own transformation, going, you know, from a kind of Harvard education to some of the larger firms in New York City in the early 60s, to a country, and this is one of the reasons he wanted to live there, that had become a paragon of kind of anti-colonial movements, the first sub-Saharan African country to achieve independence, a place where modernism and struggles of self-determination were seen as very much in concert with one another, not in in contradistinction. So Bond comes back to Harlem, ready to kind of return to the United States in some ways, but looking for something that's not just working in a firm. And he finds it in the Architects Renewal Committee in Harlem, which starts as a white-led group, basically to provide planning and architectural resources to a community that hadn't had access to them so that they could try to shape urban plans themselves to influence the city government, often successful. By the 67, the tides of the Black Power movement have shaped the organization, which is seeking Black leadership, seeking a more self-determination-oriented approach to this, not having white architects help, but having people, you know, from the community kind of leading. Bond is in many ways the right person for this job. He's not from Harlem, but he's lived in Harlem. He moves back to Harlem, and he has a kind of sensitivity to move between the levers of power that still largely shape urban planning in New York and Harlem, and the community desires for something that looks different, that's more about community control. So Bond, in some ways, has had a kind of in discussions of his role at this moment in Harlem, I'd say sometimes it's described as greater than it was. He didn't found the Architects Renewal Committee in Harlem, and he only stayed for about a year and a half. But he oversaw a really important transition from kind of this idea of a advocacy model to something that was more about self-determination. He moves on to start his own firm in late 1968. That's a firm called Bond Rider Associates. And I should mention, I'm working on a book on Bond now, so I have a lot of, you know, things I can say about him. But one thing that's interesting about him is, you know, really thinking about how to balance the interest in modernism and civil rights struggles with the practicalities of being an architect. And that's really the kind of effort that he tries to shape in the years that follow this experience, where he's still largely working in places like Harlem, but trying to think about what it means for an architect to have a practice where a lot of the ideals of civil rights are still part of the work you do, but also you have to deal with the contingencies of being an architect, which is, you know, often shaped by the people you're working for, the kinds of projects you get, not to mention the larger question of what kinds of opportunities an African-American architect gets, which are just different in this period, certainly, than a white architect. So, you know, the story to sort of tell after that is definitely too long for this venue, but I think it's interesting to think about, you know, how does an architect or an activist move from the ideals of the 60s into a place where they are often having to make choices, make compromises, navigate circumstances that are beyond their control, and still thinking about larger questions of equality and racial justice. And he largely does that through projects like housing, like civil rights related work that you mentioned, sites related to Black history. And certainly the last of those was the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which his firm wins in a team just after he died in February of 2009.
I want to pivot slightly, Brian, since you mentioned housing there for a second. Can you talk a bit about sort of how Harlem's housing typologies have changed in the latest wave of gentrification? Because I think about this as, you know, all of New York in the Bloomberg years and into the de Blasio years has basically been de-densifying as, you know, the wealthiest brownstone neighborhoods have all basically been turning back into single-family homes. You know, I'm back living again in Carroll Gardens, for example, where, you know, a number of brownstones that once held four or five families now hold one. How does that play out in Harlem? Because obviously that's been a huge wave of gentrification through there too. And of course, the history of Harlem going from wealthy Dutch neighborhood once upon a time before the original Harlem Renaissance. So how is that in flux?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, a very large part of the story has been basically shifting de facto multifamily housing into single family housing, and the brownstones are the embodiment of that. And I think you said it well. The second, kind of version of that is multifamily housing that follows some of the same kinds of models you can see elsewhere in New York City. I'd say between 6 and 20 story buildings, that are apartment buildings, often developed by fairly well-known developers. I think also sort of small projects in between, smaller developments, some of which, in my story are by community-based organizations. So groups that form at a moment when Harlem housing was not very secure and tried to develop different kinds of housing to meet different kinds of income levels in the neighborhood. And those are a mix between, renovations of tenement buildings, combining brownstones, restoring brownstones, and building new construction at a variety of scales. But you can kind of see walking around the neighborhood, there's a mix of from the lovingly restored brownstone to the brownstone that still houses three or four families to the often on like 8th Avenue, Frederick Douglass Boulevard, or 7th Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard, these kind of mid-rise buildings. And then when you go down to the park, you start to see much taller buildings that could be on the Upper East Side or could be, downtown. They don't look that different from any other new construction in New York City. I will say one other thing. Sorry, you reminded me. There was an interesting twist in the census that happened, I believe, in 2020. Basically, Harlem, if I'm going to get this right, was getting older, and family sizes were getting smaller. And, that is very much an artifact of a population that is having fewer children but has greater means. And that's, I think something you described well, Greg, right? The idea that you're getting more affluent families moving in, restoring brownstones, de-densifying, as you said, and having maybe one or two kids. So it's a sort of a strange population kind of pattern happening where in some ways it's getting younger, but the number of children isn't actually getting larger. And that is generally a sign of different kinds of folks moving in.
While we were on the subject of building typologies, we had talked about housing, which is obviously a very significant issue and remains so. As far as the commercial buildings were concerned, I was relating at the top of the cast that I had visited Harlem and when I was a New York resident in the early 2000s, late 1990s, and I recently walked back down 125th Street for the first time in more than 20 years. So I saw vestiges, of the old Harlem. The Apollo is obviously still there. The few hair braiding shops, some street musicians. It seemed pretty vibrant, pretty alive. So that was good, but it also seems sort of overrun by bland big box stores. I'm not sure if it's the future that the architects and the activists of the time envisioned. But, to the point really, though, is do you think that the present community sees this as a sign of success and self-determination, or is it what they want, or is it, is that different from what academics and activists want?
I think to answer that question, it really depends who you're asking. I think that's a very good question, but a complicated one. I think there are many longtime residents who were very glad, by the 90s to have a real supermarket in Harlem. The Pathmark that opened at Lexington 125th was basically the first supermarket the neighborhood had had. And in a place where groceries had often, been through small corner stores, bodegas, which, were basically kind of the retailers of a couple major wholesalers, were not inexpensive places to shop. Quality varied a lot. So in those cases, you see a real sort of joy about the ability to buy, good quality ingredients. And similarly, the shopping centers that we talked about earlier, Greg mentioned Harlem, USA. People were excited that you could buy music and clothes and things that people need, without leaving the neighborhood. Those are also projects that I mentioned, that come out of community organizations and community development desires. So in those cases, I would say there's really traceable ways that you could say that they grow out, even if, through maybe some meanders, some of the ideals of self-determination of earlier eras. I do think that it starts to change at some point. And the really emblematic example of this is in 2017, a Whole Foods opened across from the state office building block. And the Whole Foods opened just about the same time that the Pathmark supermarket closed. And the Pathmark supermarket, in a story that's quite complicated, was sold to Extel, which is one of the city's largest developers. And that was a real, I think, signal of a moment of change where, yes, 125th Street still had a supermarket, but now it's a Whole Foods. Whole Foods had just been purchased by Amazon at that point. Pathmark, which is a supermarket associated with A&P and was known for having affordable prices, closes, and the land that Pathmark, you know, had been on is going to be developed in some fashion by one of the more ambitious developers in the city. So that's, I think, a very symbolic transition that you can read in other versions of the street. And so I think there's certainly still people, and some of them are new arrivals, who are extremely glad to be able to buy things on 125th Street that they need, you know, have a CVS nearby, a bank branch, if people still use bank branches, you know, some groceries, clothing, that kind of stuff. But there's also a degree to which just, you know, as you see in New York in general, there's some monotonizing of that kind of retail. I say all this, you know, with the full knowledge that the chain retail in New York City has been kind of totally scrambled in the last few years in all sorts of ways, you know, and that idea of the kind of commercial first floor is obviously not on 8th Street and some of the other major streets. 34th is not what it was, you know, before the pandemic. But still, I think you can see the ways that I always like to use the metaphor of the train, right? The train starts moving and in many ways is going in a direction that people want to see, but then starts to get moving rather quickly. And by the time it's moving fast, it's hard to stop. And so the state office building block is another good example of this. The Urban League is building a new headquarters on that block next to the state office building. And on the first floor will be a Trader Joe's and a Target. And there's a lot to be said for Trader Joe's and Target in a neighborhood that's underserved. But, of course, that's also a symbol of the ways that 125th Street is becoming more like other big cross streets in the city.
So I wanted to also ask about some of the plans that had been put forward. You include a bunch of drawings that were quite interesting. Some of them were very architecturally developed, and some were just schematic sort of site plans. So in researching the book, did you get the sense of the quality or the disposition of the proposed versus the non-completed work as opposed to what eventually got built?
So I think a lot of the drawings you're thinking of probably are those from the late 60s, which really are come out of two plans that the Architects Renewal Committee in Harlem is involved with in conjunction with community groups. And just for the sake of the listeners, you know, I can try to briefly describe them. Essentially, one plan is for an area called the East Harlem Triangle, which is kind of on the eastern side of 125th Street, north of 125th Street. The other for the area around Morningside Park. Both of those were areas that had been targeted for urban renewal, and then through a variety of efforts, some successful, were kind of restored to the hands of the community that wanted to plan them. One of the things that the kind of movement of the late 60s that comes out of is embodying is the idea that Harlem didn't need outsiders to be a successful community, that the people who lived there already were enough to be a successful community. And one of the like really wonderful things about those images is that they embody in kind of architectural drawings what that would look like. And one that I think, you know, is a kind of especially compelling one is a vision of 125th Street, the same drawing used for 8th Avenue in another plan that in many ways looks very familiar. It has buildings lining the sidewalk, a broad sidewalk, trees lining the middle of the edge of the sidewalk, and then a kind of bus-only street in the middle. The buildings really retain the streetscape that is the iconic Harlem streetscape, but the people on the street are all African-American or black people in the drawing, and they are sort of just enjoying the public realm of the place in a way that looks rather normal to, I think, a viewer now, but when it's put in context of a place where the uprooting of those people was sort of what was on the drawing boards, it's quite a profound vision. And as much as the streetscape looks familiar, it's also quite a revolution because it's coming out of a moment when the idea of kind of monumental super block construction is really common. and the notion that actually a redeveloped Harlem would just look like a Harlem that celebrates the public life of its streets, the traditional sidewalk, really is a rebuke to a kind of modernist top-down idea of urban redevelopment. Now, you asked kind of whether these come to fruition, and you know, just to talk through that single drawing, I think it's an interesting case because if you go to Harlem, as I think you just described, Daniel, a lot of 125th Street does sort of look like this, or a lot of 126th Street or 127th Street does look like this. It's a place where very much the traditional streetscape is mostly intact, except mostly for things that were built in earlier eras, where you find, like, say, public housing that was built in the 50s. Most of Harlem looks a lot like the traditional New York City streetscape. And in some ways, that is a testament to the ascendance of this idea as the kind of goal of what urban development should be, you know, not the block clearing project, but something that celebrates and embodies the kind of wonderful street qualities of a place like Harlem, something that you see throughout New York City, you know, often credited to people like Jane Jacobs, the idea of the life of the street, but also something that I would argue comes out of groups like those working in Harlem who argue for that as a means of understanding what black pride was. The irony, I suppose, is that the people in those drawings are not necessarily the people on the street today. And that is, of course, because as much as that vision became ascendant, it also became appealing to lots of different people. It became appealing to black power radicals, but it also became appealing to, speculative residential developers. It became appealing to middle-class brownstoners, white and black. It became appealing to people hoping to build maybe a new building in an empty lot that retained the streetscape but was targeted to a different kind of buyer. And that's a kind of irony, I think, that I've written a little bit about, which is the ways that the idea of kind of a Harlem that celebrates the traditional fabric of the neighborhood is an idea that it appeals to a lot of different people and in some ways is one of the kind of landscapes of gentrification in the United States, the idea of, the Jane Jacobs sort of Greenwich Village being the ideal of a lot of gentrifiers, too. And that's a real irony to the story. And it doesn't mean that the Harlemites don't still live in some of those buildings, but it does mean that that ideal isn't just a black power ideal anymore. It's really a kind of it's the ideal of the walkable neighborhood that you can find in lots of different corners of U.S. residential development.
Clearly, some idealistic objectives were put forward at the turn of the 60s into the 70s as the activists began to form community organizations and actually start working with architects and planners to make these visions happen. But there were some hiccups. There were some major problems that happened. Of course, the 70s was a pretty turbulent decade for New York and the whole country with respect to urban finances and the federal government's relationship to cities to begin with. But can you talk a little bit about what happened with some of these organizations that, I think it's a little bit, it's a simplification to say that the very activists who started these organizations sold out in some respect. But, a lot of things that were promised in terms of community determination were not delivered. And it would be interesting to sort of chart that transition from top-down urban planning, to which everyone was opposed in the 50s, to radical activism in the 60s, to a kind of mishmash in the 70s of channeling public funds through a couple of powerful individuals rather than devolving power to the community as originally intended.
Yeah, I think mishmash is a good way to think of it. And also just, you remind us that the 70s were kind of a mess, right? Like there's not an easy way to come out of the 60s without it being a complicated mess. And that certainly is the case in the 70s. People are trying to sort out all of the ideals and dashed hopes and still, persistent dreams of the late 60s. I think the simple answer to your question is that Harlem, like any community of people, is not monolithic, and there's lots of different groups within that community. And one of the things I try to do in the book is to explore the different sort of sub-communities, threads of thought, ideals that aren't always in concert with one another, even within a single neighborhood, and even within folks who all had sort of the idea that their work was intended to make Harlem a better place to live, they didn't have the same understanding of what that meant. And that's one of the interesting things about the history of community development, when we really break it down into a social history, you hear a lot about this idea of community development. It's still very much a kind of common term thrown around. But of course, community development, you know, involves the question of what is the community and what does it mean to develop it? And that's an, you know, that's a question that nobody's going to probably answer precisely the same. And you can see that in the 70s in Harlem. So a couple examples, I think, of what you're describing. One is the Harlem Commonwealth Council, the early community development corporation, really comes out of the Black Power moment. By the mid-70s, it's still promising that it will sell $5 shares to Harlemites, whose equity will then be used to you know, gain loans and gain federal dollars. The share sale never happens. And one of the very simple answers to that is because the person who led the organization, who was very charismatic and brilliant in all different kinds of ways, also just didn't prioritize participatory democracy in the same ways that his predecessors did. You know, he had a different idea of what community development meant, which for him was really about a much more paternalistic approach where a few people would make decisions about what would be profitable, and then those profits would be shared with Harlemites. And that's a very different notion of community development from something like true community ownership through shareholding. This is a gentleman named James Doughty. Was James Doughty wrong? It's hard to say. James Doughty made Harlem Commonwealth Council so big that it made the list of the top 100 black-owned businesses in black enterprise. So for him, in many ways, he was doing exactly what he wanted to do. But of course, there was a cost to that in terms of the question of democratization. There's other examples that we can point to that are part of this. One is that in the 1970s, through the Nixon administration, and then Ford, and even Carter, you see a real celebration of the local and a real distaste with the idea of a kind of activist state, a large federal government that's, you know, essentially deciding from the top down what a community needs. One of the outcomes of that is certainly a diminishing of the federal sort of share of funding, but also a change in how federal funding is administered. And you start to see a move towards what's called devolution, essentially making decisions at the community level, in the case of somebody like Nixon and Ford, giving direct grants to community groups. Well, that allows those groups to do things like buying the land that one day becomes Harlem, USA, but it also means that they don't have to depend on community, you know, small contributions to do their work because they're getting, you know, million-dollar grants from the federal government. In some ways, it severs a connection between the leader of a local organization and the constituents of that local organization. Again, it's an example of the multiple threads here, maybe more than there ever being a monolithic idea. And it's understandable in a place like Harlem where capital is difficult to come by when the federal government is interested in giving you money. You know, that money is very appealing because it allows things to happen, but it also does create the opportunity for individuals to act more autonomously, and that's something that comes at a cost. So those are just a couple examples, I think, of this larger way that there's a kind of mixing bowl happening.
It's inspiring, but it's also frustrating to watch this arc of events happen in Harlem, which is the most emblematic neighborhood in terms of, you know, social and cultural change in America. If you look at the urban advocates who are out there today, they're continuing to push for most of the same things. It's affordable housing, job opportunities, community control, humane policing. What do you think the activists who are pushing for these types of things today have to learn from the experience of Harlem in the last few decades of the 20th century?
Yeah, I mean, I hope that they find their way to this history, because I do think it has a lot of object lessons. And one of them, I think, is that, you know, it's extremely difficult to create exceptions to a kind of capitalist development model within capitalism. And that's, you know, kind of a extremely obvious thing to say. But in a lot of ways, the hopes of something like community control or community shareholders funding development or cooperative approaches to a supermarket or housing, low-income homesteaders renovating abandoned tenement buildings and gaining equity not through, you know, their pocketbooks but through their, you know, elbow grease. Those are all dreams that in some ways demand an economic system that is not purely about kind of land ownership and capitalistic development and the way that development's financed. So, you know, that's a bummer to say, but it is a reality. And so I think one thing that, you know, hopefully people can learn from a history like this is that they need to create some other kinds of system. You know, and one of those, I am interested in things like community land trusts, because I think that is a case where, in some ways, a community land trust, which is, you know, in a very sort of nutshell version, it's essentially a group that owns land and then allows people to develop, to build on the land, you know, through kind of a collective process of decision making and lease the land, you know, lease the land that they're, in some cases, home or businesses on for a very long period of time while the land itself is owned in community. That's something that embodies a lot of the cooperative ideals of the 60s, but wasn't a model that they had then. And it does have its own real, you know, sort of high bars to clear, but it's interesting. And there are land trusts, like in East Harlem, there's a land trust now. So that would be something, you know, that I think is an approach that maybe is worth thinking about. And I think the other thing, you know, which requires a certain amount of patience and tolerance and slack on the part of officials, is to let people try things that are just different. You know, one of the problems with the ideals of the 60s was that they were never really allowed to happen. You know, there just wasn't a kind of will among the political leaders to let some of the more radical things play out. You know, there was a desire for people, you know, your Nelson Rockefellers, for example, to sort of see their own dreams come true. And I think, you know, to try alternate approaches, there has to be a certain tolerance for failure, which, you know, the private market often has. And we forgive, you know, people who make bad investments and they can declare bankruptcy and move on. And, you know, I think sometimes that level of tolerance doesn't exist for more community-based dreams. And it would be interesting to try some of these kinds of more radical ideas and see what happens.
Well, I was going to ask as a follow-up to that, Brian, is, I mean, I'm curious how your book and your explorations into this deal with that sort of question of, like, of racial capitalism, because I love CLTs. CLTs, of course, were founded by black farmers in Georgia in the 1960s, but CLTs are often embraced by, and I will refer to myself only as this, as, like, members of the white intelligentsia. Like, it's a very, in that respect. And then I've spoken with, like, architects like Melvin Mitchell, who, you know, has advocated for basically, like, a vertically integrated black American architectural capitalism development industrial complex, so they as a community can reap the wealth that comes from land. And I'm curious, like, how those tensions play out. I mean, you know, I think when Magic Johnson arrived there, part of the whole reason he was greeted so warmly is not just they wanted a movie theater, but you had a black successful American businessman who could deliver it too. I'm curious, how do those tensions play out in, like, the patterns of development in Harlem, and what lessons for other, you know, traditionally black enclaves across America?
It's such an interesting question, and I think you point to the ways, you know, one of the things I really want to emphasize in this book is that, you know, I may read these different points of view and have my own personal opinion about which one is more, optimistic or which one would be more exciting to see, but the reality is that all of these were different kinds of dreams that people had, and, you know, certainly like James Doughty, who I mentioned earlier, was an African-American plumber who ends up leading this really interesting community development corporation. And certainly, you know, some people were very frustrated with him. But like the Magic Johnson example you just gave, it's a case where actually you see some of the real ideals of community development unfolding. Calvin Butts, who we haven't mentioned, is another person. He leads the Abyssinian Baptist Church, is kind of the de facto leader of the Abyssinian Development Corporation, which becomes one of the most important housing developers in Harlem throughout the 80s and 90s. And, you know, also somebody who some people regard as kind of, you know, having made choices that maybe weren't always in the most democratic way, but certainly inarguably becomes a central player in development in Harlem and even beyond Harlem. So, you know, we have to understand that that is actually the ideal of black self-determination. It's just maybe not on the scale that we hope to see. I think Melvin, I'm glad you brought up Mel, who, you know, is a really interesting thinker about these questions, and I think does offer, you know, what does it look like to sort of think about and, you know, practice some of these ideas, not by creating an exception to the system, but by essentially just letting other people do this and not maybe only determining it through, you know, who has kind of their foot in the market already. And I'm not the person to sort of say how that happens, but I do think it's worth, you know, trying, like, rather than saying some sort of mini socialism or a socialism carve out, like letting, you know, black developers do the same things white developers have done and hoping that maybe the ideals will be a more inclusive one than you see. I will admit to being skeptical because I think, you know, there are real estate developers of many different races and identities and ethnicities in New York City, and they all sort of have to play a similar game in many cases, but it's certainly compelling. And you know, Mel sees ways that architects and others can be part of that too, which is certainly a new role for architects in Harlem, and would be maybe something worth trying. But yes, that's a thorny question and a tough one that I don't think I can ultimately resolve, but it's the big question.
Well, we don't have all the answers here, but we do try to ask the big questions. So thank you so much, Brian Goldstein, for joining us today. Brian Goldstein, the author of The Roots of Urban Renaissance, Gentrification, and the Struggle Over Harlem. And this has been another episode of Unfrozen.
I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do until you put under pressure. Cross 110th Street is a hell of a tester.